Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. On today's program, Words and Music. Bobby McFerrin, he's a man who makes a habit of taking music to uncharted waters. We'll be talking with him just a little bit later. But first, words matter. The choice of words and the tone we use in saying them play a significant role in today's political discourse in America. We're joined by Stephen Prothero. He says Americans have forgotten how to talk to each other. Such words from him can often be heard on NPR and cable news channels. He's a New York Times bestselling author and professor of religion at Boston University. His most recent book is The American Bible, How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation. Stephen, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I would like to ask you to explain a couple of things that I've been reading that you have said. I probably have paraphrased some of this, but elaborate, if you would, on you say American politics is broken. Americans have forgotten how to talk to each other. Instead of arguing on behalf of our nation, we argue on behalf of our party.
Well, this is a longstanding problem in American politics. George Washington worried about it when he said he warned us about the mischiefs of party, that we need to remind ourselves that we're Americans first, and in that case, Federalists second or Jeffersonians. I think we have a similar problem today where, you know, the parties and our politics is supposed to be serving the country, but often it gets turned around and the country seems to be serving the parties. And my particular interest in the American Bible is looking at ways in which we as a country have these certain core texts that we keep going back to, that we argue about, that provides a little common ground, a little reason for hope in a time when partisan politics seems to have taken us down a rabbit hole that seems hard to get out of.
Yeah, so it's no worse today, really, than it has been in our past.
Well, you know, it does come and go. I mean, I'm a historian, so this is one thing historians like to say, that, well, this seems unprecedented and, you know, you should see the election of 1800. That was pretty bad. So I think we're down in a real low point, but we've had low points like this before.
You say our differences are differences of interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, in the sense that, you know, the way I got this book project started a few years ago was I was working on a history of the culture wars in America, times when, like ours now, where we have these fights that are political, cultural, moral, and religious all at the same time, and where things get pretty nasty and people, you know, call each other, you know, traitors and stuff like that. And it seemed to me that even in the midst of those culture war points, that Americans were appealing to the same text, that we were appealing to the Constitution and to the Declaration of Independence and to the Gettysburg Address and to JFK and Lincoln and these people. And that what we were doing was we were just reading the text in a different way. But there was some common ground there in the sense that at least we were arguing about the Declaration, or at least we were arguing about Lincoln and his legacy, rather than simply racing off with our heroes into different corners of the room.
I wonder, given all the discussion today with regard to the Supreme Court and discussion over original intent, how valuable is that in today's discourse?
Well, I don't think the Constitution or the Declaration or any of these, you know, books that I've found, you know, in the American Bible, the ones that really we treat as something like Scripture. You know, I'm not talking here, by the way, about a translation of the Bible. I'm talking about Bible in quotes, like the canon that we appeal to. And I think that there isn't any one answer that these texts give us. Just like the Constitution isn't going to tell the Supreme Court how to rule on any of the cases it hears this year. It's going to give certain values like liberty or equality, but it's not going to say, oh, by the way, when liberty and equality collide, you should pick liberty. The Constitution doesn't tell you that. Mm-hmm. And neither does the Declaration of Independence, and, you know, neither does, you know, Thomas Jefferson's first inaugural address. These things that we appeal to, they typically articulate multiple and competing values. And then the way they live is through commentary and controversy, and that's where we the people come in, that we then fight about these things. We decide in the way that, say, Lincoln decided in his Gettysburg Address, that this was a country founded on equality, not a country founded on order. And that was a discovery and innovation. It wasn't just a reading of the Declaration of Independence.
How should we approach these documents then?
Well, I think we should approach them with a certain kind of reverence, in the sense that these are documents that our parents and grandparents and the founding fathers in many cases revered. but we should also approach them as living documents, that these are the way they are kept alive, just like the Constitution is kept alive through the Supreme Court and through the arguments we make about it, just as the Bible itself, I would add, you know, is kept alive by, you know, Christians who argue about it. These texts are kept alive by the controversies that we stir up about them and the competing interpretations that we come up with. And so, yes, there's something great about the I Have a Dream speech, but part of what makes it living is that we can still go back to it and say, well, what does this tell us about affirmative action? You know, what does this tell us about gay marriage? You know, and the fact that we can do that with that text is part of what makes it living and vibrant.
When you speak of living documents, that immediately, with regard to the Constitution, puts you in conflict with at least four members of the Supreme Court, I would think.
Well, you know, Justice Souter, what's their view, that the Constitution's dead or that it doesn't need to be interpreted and that they should be fired because we don't need them to decide what it means? I mean, Chief Justice Souter had a wonderful speech he gave at Harvard a few years ago, 2010 commencement address. And in that speech, he said that the Constitution does not tell judges how to decide a case. It gives you the values that you're going to appeal to, and those values are often competing and incommensurate, and it doesn't give you a hierarchy of how to read them. And that what you're supposed to do as a justice is choose, is make decisions. And I think this is true about the Bible itself, the Christian Bible, that there are some people who think you can just ask a question of the Bible. What does the Bible think about slavery? You know, what does the Bible think about gay marriage? And you can just go to it and get an answer. I don't think that's true. I think like any great text, the Bible itself and the Constitution are multivocal. You know, they have a lot of things going on inside them. And yes, it is up to us. And I would say not just the Supreme Court, but up to Americans today, to decide what they think that the Constitution says about, you know, about gay marriage.
But should we all be on the same page? Should we all have the same interpretation of either Scripture or any of the documents that we're talking about?
I don't think so, and I think it's the nature of the documents that I mean. There are documents, and there are portions of documents that are pretty incontestable, right? Like, how old do you have to be president of the United States? You know, I mean, this is not, you know, a confusing matter, but it is confusing when you ask the big sorts of questions, the things that really matter. You know, Justice Scalia said in talking about gay marriage the other day, you know, when do people get a right to be married to someone of the same sex? Like, when did that happen? Did that happen in 1972? Mm-hmm. Did that happen? His point is the originalist point that you're bringing up, that if it wasn't there at the beginning, then it's not there. And Ted Olson, I think it was, who was the attorney on the other side, said, mm-hmm. Well, you know, when did it become unconstitutional to segregate on the basis of race in our public schools, right? Yeah. And you know, my answer is, well, 1954, Brown v. Board of Education. Before that, it was contested. After that, it was a matter of settled law. Same thing with abortion, with Roe v. Wade in 1973. Those are two of the Supreme Court cases that I see as part of our canon, as part of the American Bible. So no, we shouldn't agree. And I think it's a sign of democracy and vibrancy that we don't agree. And if we agreed on all these things, I would be worried for our society.
You're speaking tonight at Ladue Chapel. I'll have more on that a little bit later. But your address is Our Uncommon Creed, Reflections on the World's Religion and American Politics. Creed and a common or uncommon creed is something that is important to you. Where do you go with that? Do we need a common creed or not? Or, as you've just said, we want to look at things differently.
Well, we have, as the United States, always had a lot of diversity here. One thing we often forget is how much linguistic diversity we had in the colonies in early America. There was some talk after we had got independence from England about us speaking German as a country, and there was also talk of us speaking Hebrew as a country. Why would we want to continue with English? You know, but those are the people we just overthrew. Why would we let them control our conversations with their language? So a lot of diversity from the beginning. We've always had this fear about our pluribus kind of overcoming our unum. You know, how do we keep together given how culturally, linguistically, religiously diverse we are? So we've always had people who have said, we're held together by a common creed. You know, we believe X, Y, and Z. That's what holds us together. And as a historian looking back over the course of American history, I can't find that ever, and I don't find it I don't find it now. Sometimes we agree on certain values. This is a democratic country. This is a Republican country with a small r. This is a country devoted to liberty or equality or capitalism or whatever it might be. But we never agree on how to mix those, and we never agree on even what those things mean. So we've never had a common creed. And I think that that makes people nervous. You know, Bill Clinton said a few years ago, well, we have a common creed. You know, there's historians who make the claim that we have a common creed. And I just don't think that exists. But I do think what holds us together is a practice and a ritual. And that ritual is arguing about what our common creed is, arguing about our so-called sacred texts. And that conversation, that argument, I think is the sort of the rite of our – the ritual of our republic. And what worries me is that we've forgotten how to do that. We've forgotten how to do that thing that holds us together. But I don't think we need a common creed. I think we just need a manner of talking about disagreeing about the things we hold dear.
If we've forgotten how to do that, how do we get it back?
Well, I think one thing we do is we look into this history that I'm trying to resurrect in the American Bible book, where we have in there what I refer to as a great tradition of conciliation, where we have people who have consistently said, you know, don't think of yourself as member of a region. Don't think of yourself as member of a party. Think of yourself as a member of the United States. Think of yourself as American. So people like Patrick Henry saying, I'm not a Virginian. I'm an American. This is a period when a lot of people referred to their colony as their country. Thomas Jefferson included used to talk about Virginia as his country. Or people like George Washington in his farewell address warning us against the mischiefs of party and saying we should be putting our United States above our political parties. Or in recent times, John F. Kennedy in his inaugural address, civility is not a sign of weakness. Or Barack Obama in his famous 2004 speech at the Democratic National Convention, you know, don't think of yourself as members of red states and blue states. Think of yourself as members of the United States. Or President Bush after the contested election with Gore, you know, saying let's come together, Republicans and Democrats. Let's see ourselves as members of one country. So we have a tradition there. It's not like we only have people like, you know, Rush Limbaugh or MSNBC hosts or whatever who are sort of saying crazy things on the secular left or the religious right. We have a great tradition of conciliation we can draw on and be inspired by.
Have to take a break now. Our guest is Stephen Prothero, professor of religion at Boston University. His most recent book about which we're talking is The American Bible, How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation. By the way, Stephen will be appearing tonight as part of the Lee Institute speaker series at 7:30 p.m. at Ladue Chapel on Clayton Road. His subject is Our Uncommon Creed, Reflections on the World's Religions and American Politics. The event is free and open to anyone who would like to show up. We'll be back and continue our conversation with our guest in just a moment. By the way, if you have examples of how words matter and how some of our documents perhaps have influenced us or have not influenced us, we'd very much like to hear from you at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. You can also reach us through Facebook. Back with Stephen Prothero in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Stephen Prothero, professor of religion at Boston University. You know, it occurs to me, Stephen, that people can look at documents and songs and many of the things that you cite in your book and really interpret anything they want out of it, which keeps us pretty much in the same place. They're not likely necessarily to be moved by what they read in another direction. It reinforces some of those things.
I think there's some truth to that. I do think that there are limits to plausible interpretations, right? So, I mean, I don't think that you – I mean, for example, when Martin Luther King says in his I Have a Dream speech, you know, that he's imagining this time when people will be judged, you know, by the content of their character instead of by the color of their skin. You know, there's – people on the right use that now to argue against affirmative action. I think I would argue against King's intentions probably. But – It's a plausible interpretation. You know, there's a tension between, you know, judging everybody in a kind of colorblind way and then addressing the problems of racism and slavery and segregation in America's past through some sort of redress of grievances, right? There's a tension there between, you know, competing American values of, say, fairness and justice and equality. So I would put – you know, Rush Limbaugh's interpretation there, you know, in a realm of perfectly plausible though I think incorrect in interpretation. But you know, you can't, you know, you can't get from the Declaration to something like, you know, we should have a society where everybody's a millionaire except for 10 people. You know, I mean, you just can't, you know, you just can't, you can't get there from there. And I think for the most part, we do tend to look at these documents, whether they are, you know, novels like Uncle Tom's Cabin, which I also, you know, include, or mm-hmm. songs like God Bless America. You know, we use these to have arguments about how Christian the society should be. And I think that I do think in general that to go back to these documents, which are most of them, in my opinion, much smarter than what we mostly hear on television today, it actually has a salutary effect on our politics, that even if we head off in slightly different directions from the text, it takes us back to some wisdom rather than to the kind of foolishness that we often hear on the air.
Let me just raise one issue that is talked about a lot these days, and that is gays. People will point to the Bible and say the Bible says very clearly that this is wrong and that these people are wrong. Can you kind of elaborate on that? I mean, what do people see? And they interpret it the way they want to interpret it, although it's can be pretty obscure.
On the question of homosexuality,
yeah,
in the Bible?
Yeah, homosexuality.
Well, let me do what Ted Olson did in the Supreme Court the other day. I answer your question with a question. What about slavery in the Bible? What's your sense about that?
Well, there certainly was slavery in the Bible.
Yeah, I mean, my sense is the Bible is pro-slavery. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I think the Bible is pro-slavery and the Bible is opposed to homosexuality. Now, that's very broadly, you know, I mean, very broadly put, but here's the narrower way to put it, that I think there's a better biblical case to be made for slavery than there is an anti-slavery case from the Bible. Mm-hmm. I think you can make both. And I think on the question of homosexuality, you can make both arguments, but there's an easier case to make because there's more cases, especially in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament, where there's critiques of homosexuality. Now, I would point out there's almost nothing said in the Bible about lesbianism. This is something I like to talk about with my students, mm-hmm. that if you want to get all exercised about, you know, biblical argument against homosexuality, you should realize the argument's really against male homosexuality. There's almost nothing against about lesbianism. In fact, there's nothing in the Old Testament. There's only one passage in the New Testament that seems to have anything to do with women having sex with women. So there are some Orthodox Jewish groups that are not at all opposed to lesbianism but are totally opposed to male homosexuality because the biblical text doesn't take them that way.
What does the biblical text say about male homosexuality?
Well, I think for the most part it says it's wrong. You know, I think for the most part it says it's wrong. But you have to realize that there's other things, and this is why I brought up slavery, because initially, I mean, the debate around the Civil War was to a great extent a biblical debate about slavery, and that both sides recognized that if they could win if the Bible was with them, they were in pretty good shape. And the way it finally cashed out was that the people who were opposed to slavery finally just didn't believe that God was in favor of slavery. They just didn't. And they were puzzled by that because they had this text in front of them that seemed to be pretty open to slavery. And then they had a God whom they knew, they felt they knew, who was a God of love and a God of justice. And they just didn't believe that. So they had a real strong cognitive dissonance. So they headed toward the more spiritual interpretations of the text, right? Things like treat your neighbor as yourself, right? That God is a God of love, those kinds of things, rather than prohibitions in Leviticus that, you know, if a man lies down with a man, he should have this kind of punishment. And I think that's part of what's happening with the homosexuality question, that as more and more people get to know gays and lesbians, and as they become sort of less like, you know, fantasy creatures of our minds and more like our neighbors, that we're heading toward passages about fairness and justice and God loving everyone. And love being a capacity that's given to us by God. And toward those kind of more abstract spiritual texts and away from the more literal anti-homosexuality texts.
Yeah. We have some folks who want to get into this conversation, Stephen. Let's bring them in. We'll start with Sheila, calling from University City. Sheila, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yes, hi, thanks. I have 2 points. One, to use the analogy of the religious Bible, a lot of people who claim to take it literally don't know the original language it was written in. And, of course, any translation is somebody's interpretation. And by the same token, I think the words in the Constitution were written at a different period, and the historical context is important because words change over time. And in addition to that, most words, or many words, have more than one meaning. And so let me just stop at that and get your comment first.
Are you saying that the Bible wasn't written in English? Is that what you're telling me?
I think it was an email attachment.
Okay. Because, you know, it's interesting because in Islam, the Quran is only authoritative in Arabic. So a translation is actually not the Quran. If you're angry at Muslims and you want to burn a Quran and you burn an English Quran, you're not burning a Quran because the Quran is only the Quran in Arabic. But it is interesting that in the United States we do see the Bible as translated in English as being the Word of God, which is kind of odd. If God chose to speak Hebrew or chose to speak Greek or Aramaic, the three languages of the Bible, you know, you might think we'd be racing out as we used to, by the way, in early 19th century America in our public schools, everybody learned how to read Greek and how to read Hebrew so they could read the Bible. That was very important. So, but I take your point about translation. I think that is a problem at the margins. I don't know that, you know, we read translated novels all the time and we read translated texts and we get the gist of them, I think, in most cases. There are cases where translation is very important and vexing. I also think you're right about the history of the way words are used. You know, we have a debate now about guns, right? And certainly the founders were not thinking about, you know, assault rifles with, you know, magazines where you could take 30 shots in 30 seconds or whatever. Obviously they couldn't have thought about that because that wasn't a possibility. So they're thinking about muskets and, you know, we're thinking about something else and we're using the same word gun to talk about those two things. And those provide interpretive challenges for us. So I do think we do need to think about the way words and concepts were used in prior times in terms of our interpretation of all of these texts.
Yeah. Let's bring in Ed calling from St. Louis. Ed, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to just make a comment, really, just because I felt this was, it was a little flippant what the guest said about was it written in English? Because the guy who wrote it in English, Tinsdale or somebody like, got burned at the stake. I mean, really, he got burned, and really, that's not so funny. The reason I called though is I took comparative religions in college, and really, what we ought to do is we should teach the inconsistencies in the Bible. Things that are mentioned in the Bible, they both can't happen. And people study wait a minute, these two things cannot be true. You know, either one's right or one's wrong, you know. And that's what there's so many inconsistencies in the English Bible.
Thanks for the call, Ed.
You know, I did a book years ago called Religious Literacy where I talked about how the United States is one of the most religious countries on earth, and yet Americans know almost nothing about religion, their own religion, or the religion of other people. And I said that in order to make sense of American politics, where politicians are so often invoking the Bible and talking about, you know, what Jesus would do about immigration, or, you know, what the highest marginal tax rate would be if Jesus were the president, things like that, that we should make a bigger effort to, you know, read the Bible and understand the Bible. And so I argued that we should have Bible courses in our public schools, not as, you know, the Bible as the truth, but the Bible as literature. And I think we should have world religions courses for a similar reason, that we live in a furiously religious world where religion is at the center of many of our crises and conflicts. And we need to know something about Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism and other religions to make sense of it. But I don't think the place to start is by, you know, undercutting religion from a, you know, skeptic's perspective or whatever it might be, or from a believer's perspective. I think what we need is some more dispassionate analysis of, you know, this is what this Bible story is, or this is what this religion teaches about this particular issue. And I think we'd be a lot better off if we just had a greater understanding of the world's religions and the Bible that the Supreme Court itself has urged on us in many cases that it's decided on religion and public education.
But it seems in today's environment, it seems to me that people will search through whether it's the Bible or anything else, and interpret it the way they want to interpret it, just, you know, to meet whatever their particular agenda happens to be.
Yeah, but, you know, that's true. But when you are grounded in a text, you then have to defend it. So you can say, oh, you know, I'm in favor of the Bible, so we should invade, you know, Iran. You know, you can say that. But then as soon as you say that, you're invited then. You're almost demanding a retort, which is, well, okay, where in the Bible does it say we should invade Iran, you know? And as soon as you get there, you get to be able to have a conversation. You know, you get to realize, oh, this person has no evidence for this, or this person has some evidence for this, or maybe the Bible isn't the source we should be going to decide whether we should be invading Iran. So I just – I think I disagree with the idea that these texts are perfectly open-ended. I think there's somewhere between perfectly open-ended and making one point, which is like the originalist idea. You know, the Constitution just says something about what we should, you know, do about the case that's being discussed today in the Supreme Court of the human genome and whether you can patent that. You know, somehow the Constitution gives us the answer. I think that's absurd. So I think it's some between those two things, that it's purely open-ended and that it's kind of settled by any reasonable reader.
Back to the phones, and John joins us from Hazelwood. John, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to comment on the biblical interpretation of homosexuality. I think a lot of people interpret, you know, that the prohibition against homosexuality in the Old Testament, you know, is right along stuff without, you know, what kind of fabric you can wear and a shellfish, you can't eat shellfish and so forth. And they say that, you know, the New Testament is a new covenant and throws all those other things out, so that sort of eliminates the Old Testament prohibitions against homosexuality. And if you read the New Testament, in the four Gospels, Jesus never has anything to say about homosexuality whatsoever. It's all Paul that you can even make any interpretation whatsoever. But Jesus, in three or four places, has strict prohibitions against divorce, yet we don't have any problem with divorce in our society today. So I don't know, I don't find any place in the Bible other than Paul. It's not Jesus that's saying it, it's Paul that's saying it for prohibitions against homosexuality. So I'm not sure where the problem comes.
That's great. I mean, see, this is the exact kind of conversation I'm interested in promoting about things like the Gettysburg Address and the Declaration, because you make six or seven really good points there. You know, once you decide that you've got this kind of old covenant, new covenant thing happening with the Bible, you know, and you're going to eat lobster, right? You're a Christian, you're going to eat lobster. You're not supposed to eat it, but you're going to eat it, or you're not going to eat pork. Because that's the old thing. That's just if you're Jewish. You know, it doesn't apply to Christians. Well, okay, the Ten Commandments are in the Old Testament. Are we giving up the Ten Commandments? So yeah, this is the sort of problem of what is sometimes called the canon within a canon. You know, you've got this biblical text. You're supposed to be following the whole thing, but nobody's following the whole thing. Even the most literalist readers and the most fundamentalist evangelicals are really focusing on certain things, and they're focusing on the things that preoccupy them. When I was growing up, you know, nobody really talked much in Christian circles about sexuality. It just wasn't a big deal, especially homosexuality. They were arguing about other things, you know. They were arguing about communion and is Jesus really present at the communion, these sorts of things. So we are obsessed with sexuality post-1960s, and now we're talking about homosexuality. So we just think this is the central issue, and Jesus didn't think so. He didn't talk much about it at all. He never talked about it. And like you say, he did talk about divorce. And in the Gospel of Mark, at least, he says you're not supposed to get divorced. And, you know, there aren't a lot of Christians in America who are all worried about that. You know, why is that? Well, because we interpret these texts over against our contemporary circumstances. And if we didn't do that, they would die, all of them. That would be true of the Constitution. That would be true of the Declaration. And it would be true of the Bible as well.
He also talked a lot about inclusion. And there are a lot of people who profess to follow the word of Jesus, but will have no part of that in certain areas.
Well, and the poor. You know, you read the Gospel of Luke, it seems that all Jesus thinks about is the rich and the poor, you know. So at least if you read that particular gospel or you read the Hebrew Bible prophets, issues of justice and poverty and wealth are really central.
We only have about 2 minutes left. I'm interested in view of all that we've been talking about here, that another part of our conversation today is the loss of civility. I'm sure you're well aware of that. What is happening here?
Well, I don't know. I take a little bit of a long view. You know, back in the election of 1800, it was pretty uncivil. People were accusing Thomas Jefferson of, interestingly enough, being a Muslim. That was one of the things that our Thomas Jefferson, our third president, was accused of. So things have been bad in the past. I think they're bad now, really bad now. I think that's a combination of social media. I think cable TV news is really a contributor. But I think there's also this issue of amnesia that we have forgotten. We don't listen to Lincoln enough. You know, here's a guy who in the midst of the Civil War is saying, we must be friends, we must not be enemies, you know, to people in the Confederacy. This is an extraordinary statement. And it's not a statement we hear much from politicians today, either in the Democratic or the Republican parties.
That's why you say, why let Pelosi and Boehner dictate the dialogue when Jefferson, King, and Lincoln are in the room?
Exactly. I mean, these are great voices, and we should be listening to those voices more, and we should be listening to the craziness a little bit less. And I do think that our democracy, you know, hangs on this. Democracies are messy. Democracies are always multivocal. There's always contest. There's always disagreement. And what's important is to have that carried forward in a manner in which we don't kind of excommunicate one another from the family of Americanness. And that's what I'm worried about, that we're doing too much of today.
That's Stephen Prothero. He'll appear tonight as part of the Lee Institute Speaker Series at 7:30 at LeDoux Chapel on Clayton Road. Thank you so much for being with us. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks, Don.
Coming up, Bobby McFerrin. You all know who Bobby McFerrin is. He's going to be talking about his St. Louis connection and how music is more than just notes and a melody. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.